Welcome to the Natural History Cupboard. Come on in.
And welcome back to the Natural History Cupboard podcast, the place where the weird and wonderful parts of the natural world come together. I'm your host, Gareth, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Erin. Erin, say hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. You were resisting every urge there not to do that in an Arnold Schwarzenegger voice, weren't you? Before recording, listeners, we were playing around with the idea of doing the entire episode in our Arnold Schwarzenegger voices because of today's topic, which will become apparent as we go on. But we will not be doing that for obvious reasons. So how are you this week, Erin? Feeling a lot more alive?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I am good also. Yeah, it's been an interesting week. Not really had much going on wildlife-wise or natural history-wise, just getting the last few bits sorted for this this thing at the, well, as of time of release, we'll have finished the thing at the library and be planning our next big thing. Why not?
This is the last recording before the live show and the first episode release after the live show.
So if you don't hear anything after this episode, it means that
we've been cancelled.
Have revolted and killed us. Yeah.
I said a little bit too much about Southwest Water.
Oh yes, yeah. Best left unsaid. So yeah, what have you been up to?
To be honest, not much. I'm racking my brains of what I've done. I've got the PowerPoint for this this live show done. Talked to a couple of people regarding the live show, couple of the people who are organizing it. I've conferred with you over it. The solar eclipse that was going on in America. I spent some time with Atta talking our daughter through what an eclipse was. She wasn't interested.
It's not the end of the world. Don't worry.
Oh no, she's not a science denier.
I'm assuming. Well, I mean, we can't stare directly at it because we're on a different part of the planet, but I'm assuming she'd also be smarter than a certain former president who, when told, "Don't stare at the eclipse, sir," went, "What?" and stared directly at it.
Is that true?
It was on live TV.
Oh, I didn't. I don't watch TV, so.
It's one of his more hilarious moments.
That's one of the times that I wish I had TV. Well, actually, there you go. There's the whole weekend, like Saturday was WrestleMania night one, Sunday was WrestleMania night two, Monday was watching Donald Trump getting blinded by an eclipse. I think
no, that wasn't this time. Weekend. That wasn't this time.
Oh,
that
it was last time.
The last eclipse, yeah.
Oh, what a shame.
Quite a while ago. But yeah. It's well, I mean, I can't remember the last eclipse that we had here in the UK.
The last one we had, I think, was 1999.
No. Actually, it wasn't. No, it can't be because, and this is completely off the topic here when it comes to eclipses or somewhat similar. It must have been anywhere between 2012 and 2020 in the UK because I was working at the zoo at that point, and we went out onto the front lawn to watch it, and it must have been sometime it was sometime sort of mid-July-ish because we had a very brief window before the zoo opened to be able to observe it.
That wouldn't have been a total solar eclipse though. That would have been partial.
It was still pretty good.
It could have been, yeah, I was going to say it could have been like majority, but a total solar eclipse was when I was in school, and I was, well, it was during my school time. I was of an age where I would be in school, but it was a weekend. So I was with my dad. I believe it was a Sunday. We were down in Bude. And we didn't see anything because it was cloudy.
That's the one problem with eclipses in this country. They could be happening all the time. We'd just never know. Anyway, Eclipses aside, yeah, I don't think either of us have been a particularly wildlife-heavy week this week. So,
negative.
Well, shall we move on into the news?
Affirmative.
Oh God.
It's the news.
Right, well, we're into the news for this week. Aaron, what do we got?
Well, firstly, a couple things right off the bat there. Between last recording and this recording, it was Jane Goodall's birthday.
It was, yes. So happy birthday to the, I'd say, the queen of primatology, really, Jane Goodall.
And today, Sir David Attenborough turns 97.
Does he?
Yeah.
How on
today,
earth
as in the day that we're recording.
How on earth did I not manage to flag that up? I had all these things written down, and I completely missed that one. Well, I
was
rather
a bit
silly for
doing
that.
Shocked myself. I was a bit shocked that I missed that one myself. Yeah. So there you go.
Happy birthday to the one and only, and many may he be with us for many, many more years, Sir David Attenborough.
Yeah. Yeah. As young as he ever was, I say. Yeah, but on to the news, I suppose. So every week, the weird and wonderful world of natural history offers up an embarrassment of riches when it comes to news and interesting stories. And though we here at the Natural History Cupboard are but a small team, it's our aim to keep you, our fellow cupboard dwellers, up to date on the good, the odd, and the exciting. So let's open up the Natural History Cupboard newsreel, where we've compiled some of the more interesting headlines, and dive in. Now, before Gareth goes with his first article, there was one other off the top that I wanted to mention that I forgot when we're going through the birthdays. It is also International Pygmy Hippo Awareness Day on this day of recording.
I am aware of pygmy hippos. Should we be aware of them around us at the moment? Or
I have one underneath the table right now sleeping with the cats. I do not.
It's not one of those Canadian house hippos, is it?
It is not.
Well, okay, I will launch into things. Hippo, minus hippo for mine. My first story comes to us from the Kakapo Recovery Trust, which, you know, I love a Kakapo. And when you talk about Kakapo, you've got to picture the main one that gets everyone's attention, which if you've seen that documentary with Stephen Fry and Mark Cowardine, where they went to New Zealand and they had a certain kakapo sitting on their heads trying to mate them, you would be aware of Sirocco, the kakapo. Well, just the other week, he celebrated his birthday, which was on the 23rd of March, and he was born all the way back in 1997. So he's doing pretty well for a bird of 27. It was initially hatched out, and I love the post that they had for this, which was the in 1997 Buffy was slaying vampires, Jack was king of the world, and Martina was smashing it. Platform spiced up your life, while Umbop dubbed. Oh, I'm not doing the rest of that. Basically, lots of stuff happened in 1997. It was Spice Girls, Buffy, Titanic, all of that. Yeah. But a small egg was hatching on an island in New Zealand, and it was Sirocco's birthday. So he's 27 years old this year. So happy birthday to Sirocco.
Oh. My first article comes to us from fizz.org. The headline is Dinosaur Study Challenges Bergman's Rule. So just to keep us all on the same page, Bergman's Rule is from the 1800s and states that species in high latitude, cooler climates grow larger than their more comfortably living relatives in warmer climes. But turns out the fossil record doesn't agree. A new study carried out by universities of Alaska Fairbanks and Redding shows that the evolution of body size diversity cannot be reduced to simply being a function of latitude and temperature. If you read the article, you'll discover that Bergman's rule should very much be renamed Bergman's exception.
Always very cool. My next one comes to us from New Scientist, and it's snakes show signs of self-recognition in a smell-based mirror test. Garter snakes, which are some of North America's coolest snakes, I think, may recognize their own scent and react differently when it's altered, hinting at self-awareness in reptiles. A handful of animals, including roosters, horses, and cleaner fish, have shown signs of self-awareness in what is known as the mirror test. This involves putting paint on an area of their body that they can't see without a mirror, such as on their forehead. If the animal touches the mark, then looks in the mirror, it suggests they are aware that their reflection is of an individual and not an image of another individual snake. But snakes and most reptiles primarily interact with the world through scent, and it would appear that, well, people's views on this are having to change as to how this is going to work. Team members collected the scents of 36 eastern garter snakes, 18 ball pythons, and wiped cotton pads along their skin. They then presented each snake with 5 scents, their own with a bit of olive oil added, just olive oil, and one of another snake of the same species, and one of another snake with a bit of olive oil on it. This is sounding delicious, actually, a bit of olive oil. No. The garter snakes performed more long tongue flicks in response to their own modified scent compared to the rest of the other scents. So, yeah, yet another thing showing that reptiles are smarter than people give them credit for.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So my second article comes to us again from fizz.org. Rare Javan rhino calf spotted in Indonesia. So no update on the tiger this week, I'm afraid, but in equally awesome news, a new Javan rhino calf has been sighted in Ujung Kulon National Park and is believed to be about 3 to 5 months old. It is believed only 82 of these rhinos still exist, and the calf, spotted with its mother in the last of Java's wild habitat, is an exciting ray of hope for the species.
Hmm. Well, you remember my whale-based story from last week, Aaron?
Oh, yeah.
The fecal fight that they used to scare off some... Well, this is whales, but it's not to do with poo this time.
The weaponized pink eye.
Yeah, but it is still pretty impressive. So from ABC News Australia, blue whale study spots males racing in rarely seen courtship ritual off South Australian coast. So two males were seen racing behind the female off the southeastern coast. And the picture they've got is quite impressive of, well, three blue whales, two of them chasing after a female. In short, the two males were spotted racing behind the female. And it's just the second time in more than 2 decades that the mating behavior has been observed by researchers in the area. The whales will migrate next from the feeding grounds in the Southern Ocean to their breeding grounds in Indonesia. So they're obviously starting to get in the mood before they start making that probably quite a distance of a trek all the way from southeastern Australia right up to Indonesia. So, it's just another case of dramatic whale behavior being spotted, and it's always good to see.
Yeah, that's really cool. So this one comes to us from IFL Science. Lizards keep evolving and losing snake venom resistance in reptile war. There are some parts of the world where snake venom resistance is a gift you don't want to lose, especially if you feed on said snakes. Researchers studying how lizards deal with the problem of snake venom came to a surprising discovery that varanids, that's the monitor lizards, have evolved 2 ways to get around venom. The first being armor, in the case of Parentes and Komodos, and the second being neurotoxin-resistant nerves, which are found in all the smaller species. When snake numbers are low, the resistance is eventually lost, only to evolve once more when snakes become locally plentiful again. Furthermore, to combat the cyclical resistance of lizards, snake venom periodically evolves too, as a means to defend the animal and turn its would-be predator into prey itself. Yeah, interesting one, that. And that just about wraps it up for this week's installment of the Natural History Cupboard Newsreel. Remember, if you guys at home have news articles or topics of interest that you think we should cover, send them in. You can use any of the usual ways to contact us, whether by email, social media, or by scent marking yourself with something and seeing if you are recognized elsewhere. That doesn't really make sense, but we'll go with it anyway. And you might just see your chosen article covered here or in our natural history news discussion. And with that said, Gareth, what is this Meeks Wayne? This Meeks Main This week's
just sit down in the corner. Just sit down.
This week's main topic.
Well, just as with my first article that I brought up, I've held on to this one for a while because it is something that is quite good. This came out on the 13th of March, and it's from it was in various different papers throughout the UK, but I've gone with the BBC's one, and it's giant redwoods, world's largest trees thriving in the UK. Spoke to me on a couple of levels for a very simple reason. I like plants, if you were unaware of that. But also, I have a bit of a connection to these trees because many years ago, I got bought a packet of giant redwood seeds as a leaving gift when I was leaving the Welsh Mountain Zoo. It was basically the end of my contract there. And as a leaving gift, somebody gave me a packet of giant redwood seeds. And I thought, wow, this would be fun. Let's grow some of these. We've got propagators and everything set up. And out of a packet of about 40, I think, or so seeds, we ended up with a good 25, sort of 30 small trees, of which over the years they lived in my parents' garden, slowly getting bigger and slowly getting bigger, to the point where every time I'd return home, or you know, return to my parents' place, my mum would be very eager to go, "So you're going to take one of the trees with you, aren't you?" And I haven't got anywhere to put them at the moment, mum. I'll have to find somewhere to get some, because I'm at the time I was living in a flat with no gardens, so couldn't really do very much with that. And over the years, I ended up giving them away to various different people and sending them off to various different places. And eventually, I was down to the last two. I think I gave one. I can't remember who I gave one to now. So the very last one I planted at the last collection that I worked at in a particularly nice patch of gardens that was there, because it was getting so tall that it was no longer feasible to be in a pot, really. So, you know, the tree is now planted in there, and as far as I'm aware, it's still sitting there. It's about the height of a person now, and a good 10 years old. So it's done pretty well, and I can only assume the same with the rest of the trees that I'd had sent out to various different people, unless they've killed them in some way or another. But this brings me to this week's article, which is the fact that giant redwoods are doing incredibly well in the UK. There are some an estimated half a million redwoods in the UK. So I can say I've grown at least 30 of them. That's I like the fact that my numbers have contributed to that in a weird way. And that includes the giant redwood, which is Sequoia dendron giganteum, also the coastal redwood and the dawn redwood. I would say the dawn redwood is far more common in garden centres. You'll probably see one if you go to a garden centre, because they're a bit of a oddity, but they don't grow as giant, obviously, as the giant redwoods do. However, though, it can take hundreds of years for a redwood to get to decent, mature size. And they can live for 2,000 years. So, they've got a bit of growing to do before they're going to be towering over the canopies of anything in the UK. But they are still some of the largest trees in the UK. So why are they doing so well here? For a very simple reason. The climate is exactly like where they come from in California. Now, you don't tend to equate California and the UK very much, do you, Aaron? They don't.
No, not really.
Well, the particular part of California that a lot of these trees like to come from is wet, damp forest. Think of basically cold, temperate rainforests up towards Washington and Oregon and all those sort of Pacific Northwest. That is where these trees like to grow. So Britain is perfect for that. They like a lot of water. They like a bit of sunshine, which we do get in the summer. But the bigger problem is we're starting to see increasingly hot summers in California and droughts. Mm. And a lot of these ancient trees are starting to die or be burnt, basically, because of wildfires. So there is very much this thought that if things continue on the way they are, the main, you know, the main sort of staple place for redwoods might not be California anymore. It might be the UK, which is a very odd thing to think of when you think of that.
Yeah.
By comparison, numbers wise, to give you an idea, so we've got 500,000 in the UK. There are some 80,000 giant redwoods in their native range in California. So the numbers are, yeah, quite stark when it comes to stuff like that. And they need to be protected in their native range. They are true giants there. The redwoods themselves, we have the Victorians to thank for bringing them here. When it comes to plants, the Victorians were one of those, well, let's just stick it in the garden, see if it grows sort of mentalities. And that seems to be very much the reason why we've got so many bizarre plants here in the UK. This study came about from scientists basically taking scans and studying all of these different trees right the way throughout the UK. They've laser scanned them to measure the heights and volumes of some of the larger trees and be able to estimate weights without obviously cutting them down. The researchers have found that the trees were growing as fast as giant redwoods in their native home in the mountains of the Sierra Nevada. The UK climate very much seems to suit them. They also pointed out as well in this study that scientists looked at how much carbon dioxide these trees absorb. And as you could imagine, a giant tree is obviously going to take in a heck of a lot more than a smaller tree. And they do store a huge amount of greenhouse gases, but it also has a little asterisk next to that saying that even though a 45 meter tall tree can take in about 10 to 15 tons of carbon in its core, basically, or into it, that still doesn't, you know, equate to the amount of damage that we are destroying the planet with. Although I do like the thought of covering the entirety of the UK with giant redwood forests and just basically turning the place into Endor.
Yes. We do need
everyone's speeder bikes.
We need more trees, although preferably, from my point of view, there'd be native trees.
Yes, native all right. Woods. Yeah. I am very much going down a, let's just get in, well, it wouldn't exactly be invasive because they're very, very slow growing. Yeah, the sad thing is these trees are very much endangered in their proper habitat. If you've ever watched Star Wars, you will recognize the forest that these grow in because it's Endor. If you've seen Harry and the Hendersons, that classic film about Bigfoot, that's also the same part. In fact, that those giant redwood forests appear in so many different films. Planet of the Apes, Without a Paddle, that's another one I can think of. So many different films that have had the giant redwood forests of North America in them.
Yeah.
Oh, Stargate as well. Anything that's filmed up towards that way, I think actually that might be Vancouver, but those sort of forests.
Yeah, I think it's Return of the Jedi and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes that comes to my mind.
Yeah. One final bit that Professor Disney, who was one of the lead scientists on this, said they have a very long life ahead of them, the trees in the UK, and they won't stay small for long. They're very fast growing and they will grow large. Once they reach about 60 meters tall, they will be the tallest trees in Britain. And then they'll just keep growing, he said. So, it will basically tower over any tree in the UK, any of our native trees, easily. And in fact, I don't think, if we remember, you and I, Aaron, have talked about going and seeing England's tallest tree. Well, that's not native. Scotland's tallest tree is not native. But we have very few of the tallest trees are native to this country. So, Britain is an oddity by the amount of non-native species that we have introduced into the UK. But in some ways, we can act as a bit of an ark for some of the rarer ones, I suppose.
Mm.
So go and get yourself a giant redwood to put in your garden. Your descendants will really, really love you for it as it towers over your house.
Yeah.
And then you can build a giant tree house.
I was going to say, build a massive treehouse, like, the disc around it, like on Endor.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, technically it's not Endor. I know this is not the podcast to do it on, but it's actually the forest moon of Endor. Endor is the planet. The where they go to is just the moon, one of the moons.
But it doesn't have a name.
It probably does, but I've don't know it or have long forgotten it.
Do you know what? I was completely unaware of that then. I'm just going to hand in my Star Wars credentials for a second.
You will go to the forest moon of Endor. There you will wait until summoned.
Fair enough. Well, shall we be summoned into your creature feature for this week?
Yes.
Let's do it. Go on. You're going to do it in Palpatine's voice. So
I was going to do it in Arnie's voice.
Go now. Get to the creature feature.
It's the creature feature.
Right, well, we're into this week's creature feature. Aaron, what are we looking at?
It's going to be a little bit of a shorter creature feature. You might be relieved to know this week. Because a bit like a very similar animal that I've done in the past, which we'll probably get a mention in a bit, this particular animal, there's kind of lots out there, and at the same time, not a lot out there. So we'll crack into it. But today we're opening the cupboard to look at what has become fondly known as a hell pig. There is another name for it, which I particularly like, the Terminator pig, which is
I'd forgotten that name for them.
Yeah, they got some pretty cool nicknames. But to understand Deodon Shoshonensis, that's actually take two, and I still got it wrong. We need to have a little look into their family, the Entelodonts, because they're quite an odd bunch. Entelodon today is, to strip it down to basics, a family of terrifying pig-like even-toed ungulates, or artiodactyls. They existed around 38 to 19 million years ago across the entire northern hemisphere and are characterized by their incredibly large heads, narrow gait, and evidence of an omnivorous diet. Morphologically, they seem to have the appearance of a large and creepy pig or peccary. However, more recent studies into that morphology, as well as modern genetic studies, has revealed that the Entelodont family actually belongs to the Cetacodontomorphs, which you might have heard us talk about before a couple of times, and therefore they're much more closely related or linked to hippopotamus and the cetaceans, so your porpoises, whales, and dolphins.
So it's more like the Whippomorphia group.
Yes. They are, in fact, pretty distant from pigs, but they're closer to that creature feature that I alluded to, the Andrusarchus, which... As I say, I think that was all just over a year ago now. It was certainly around March 12th, I would have thought, last year. It was around March 12th, either this last season or the season before. But Andrusarchus is a really cool animal, so check that one out. It is also likely that Entelodonts could open their mouths wide, like extremely wide. That's another characteristic that they probably had. There is scope for this ability being a hunting or a feeding trait, but it is also comparable to their distant relatives, the hippos. Now, in hippos, the huge gaping maw is a competitive trait which serves to intimidate rivals and also acts as a bit of a weapon, a sparring weapon in jaw wrestling. Which sounds pretty weird now that I say that out loud.
Well, I would say if you want to learn more about those, go and check out our episode that we did on hippos.
We did
do even episode. Further back now.
It was even further back, but it was even more informative because, like I say, Andrusarchus, a very interesting animal, but not a whole deal known about them. Hippopotamus, on the other hand, lots known about them and just an incredibly cool animal. And if I'm not mistaken, the most or the second most dangerous animal on this planet. Well, third, I suppose. You'd have humans, mosquitoes, and hippos, I think it is.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So in the Entelodontidae family, fossil evidence actually supports this concept, as there's been healed puncture wounds found on fossilized bones.
And also, the low-hanging skull itself would support the bite wrestling ability of such a wide yawn. I think we probably have enough there on Entelodonts to go about with as a family. So back to this species, Deodon shoshonensis. Now, Deodon, the genus, is unfortunately as extinct as the rest of the Entelodont family is, appearing about 23 million years ago and then disappearing 3 million years later, some 20 million years ago from now. The reason for their extinction is a little bit unclear. It's not marked by any mass extinction, so there's no pop culture-esque cataclysmic Armageddon to speak of. But what seems to be the case is that their family, the Entelodonts, diversified greatly during the Eocene and Oligocene, presumably becoming more and more specialized and giving rise to creatures like the Deodon. But while the Terminator pigs were fearsome and they were adept at what they'd evolved to do, they were ecologically stubborn and unyielding to change. So as the climate changed and the ecosystems adapted to new pressures, Deodon and its kin couldn't adapt quick enough to reposition themselves. The developing environments gave rise to new, more flexible predators as well. So these would more than certainly would have outcompeted the Deodon. And it was probably all of these factors in unison that finally wiped the species and later its family out. So again, unfortunately, not around today. It would be really cool to see them, I think.
I think, didn't they go extinct roughly about the same time as the what was called the bone crushing dogs, the borophagia or whatever they're called, which were outcompeted by things like modern day wolves and or wolf relatives evolving to be smaller, faster, more adaptable predators, and unlike these big bone crushing or entelodonts and bone crushing dogs.
I think what the Entelodont family went through is actually something that was experienced across many families around in and around this period in time. They'd all specialized because there's huge gaps left that they filled, and they filled to such a degree that they, like I say, they became specialized. Then when the world changed, because change comes about relatively slowly, but then a lot of new change comes and in quite quick succession, they just can't keep up. But those new changes are creating new pressures on those environments that are creating animals that can fill those niches and be more flexible at the same time. So yeah, you get your more flexible predators that are starting to fill up these large carnivorous niches.
Always pays to be a generalist.
Yeah, it certainly does. Bringing the Deodon into modern times, the Deodon was first assembled by famed American anatomist Edward Drinker Cope in 1878. Yeah. He considered the animal to be a perissodactyl, so an odd-toed ungulate, which of course we now know they weren't. It wouldn't be until 1905, so 27 years later, that the discovery of a more complete example of Deodon forced the reclassification to Artiodactyl and positioned them in the Entelodont family, because before they, obviously, they weren't. Cope didn't nominate the name Deodon, actually. An interesting side note, he wasn't the one that gave it its name in his original description. But the name does come from Greek words. These are deos and odon, which would transfer to hostile or dreadful teeth.
Hostile teeth.
Yeah, it's a rather fitting description, I think.
Those hostile teeth over there.
Not teeth you'd like to meet. With reference to their specific name, shoshonensis, I couldn't actually find any confirmation as to what that is, but I think it's pretty safe to say it comes from the word Shoshone.
That would have been my first thought. It's to do with the Shoshone tribe.
That was my thinking the entire time looking into this, and when I've seen it written down before. But
there was nowhere that's actually written this down. So I had to say that as a disclaimer, just in case on the off chance I'm very wrong. But I think it's pretty obvious it's based on the word Shoshone.
Now I'm assuming that's a revision of that name, because I can't imagine 19th century or 18th century scientists naming things after Native Americans at that point.
No, I didn't bother writing down or taking note of the original binomial scientific name for Deodon, but it did go for a name change at some point to become Deodon Shoshonensis. That wasn't what it was originally called. As I said, Cope himself didn't actually name the animal Deodon in his original description of the animal. But yeah, I can't, without pulling it up on the internet, I couldn't tell you what the original name was. I didn't bother to take note of it. So yeah, I think it's worth diving into what Shoshone is. So the Shoshone are a Native American tribe located very much where Deodon would have once roamed. Their name, Shoshone, comes from from their own language, from the word Sosoni. I might not be pronouncing that right, but Sosoni basically means high growing grass. And this name has cultural significance to the Shoshone and their neighbors, because it is how the neighboring tribes identified the Shoshone people. They were basically naming them grass house people due to the materials that they'd use to build their traditional houses. Back to the animal, however, Deodon Shoshonensis is the largest known entelodont. Their skulls alone were absolutely monstrous, with adult sizes measuring 90 centimeters in length. So their skull is almost a meter in length. And the animal itself measuring about 1.7, 1.8 meters up from sole of the foot to the shoulders. It can be identified amongst its closest kin by having a look in its mouth, because it has a unique set of teeth, even for entelodonts. It also has small and oddly shaped cheekbone flanges and a small chin. It could also be identified by its fingers and toes, as well as evidence of fused lower leg bones. Its neck would be proportionately comparable to today's bison, as the relatively slender structure would have been supported by huge neck muscles that were anchored via the tendons to tall thoracic vertebrae spines. So this is an animal with an incredibly long skull and an incredibly thick, muscular, strong neck. It would have been really impressive and quite terrifying to come across. As I alluded to previously, these guys roamed North America, and their fossils are mostly found in agate beds. This fact in itself supports the idea of a quickly changing environment, as it is evidence of a transition period between densely forested floodplains and what would eventually be open prairies. Despite popular culture regarding the animal, the fossil record suggests that Deodon was not at all a social species. So players play an arc that are finding like big groups of Deodon together. That probably wasn't how they lived. True to entelodont form, Deodon were likely omnivorous animals, as I've already kind of mentioned. Wear and tear evidence on the fossilized teeth shows that they would have consumed a variety of foodstuffs, including meat and bones, which suggests scavenging feeding behavior and possibly some hunting behaviors, as well as nuts, roots, and vines. It's thought that their vegetation-based preferences would have been somewhat malleable, even though the animal itself wasn't particularly flexible to change. They probably used grapevines as a source of fluids during the harsher dry season. And we also know through the fossil record that surprisingly large calicophers were preyed upon by Deodon, which suggests that it was a hunter. That being said, even if it had this preference for larger animals, it could have just as likely be that it's scavenging from these larger kills. The evidence for the type of carnivory that they adopted is actually still debated, but the prevailing thought is that they employed similar feeding behaviors and habits to bears. So they would
They think that they would have scavenged mostly in terms of their carnivory, and hunted occasionally, and the rest of the time been foraging. But that is, in a rather small, concise nutshell, the Deodon, the Terminator pig or Hell pig, whichever name you prefer. I think it's a really cool animal. I'd love to learn more about them. Incredibly cool name as well. And they, from paleo artistic reconstructions, they look formidable, to say the least.
Yeah, they're sort of undergoing now a bit of a transformation, I'd say. They're not being shrink wrapped as much.
That's right, yeah.
It used to be that they were very shrink wrapped in paleo art.
Mm.
Now they're getting a bit more, a bit fleshier around the face.
Yeah, their face
getting
is
lips.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is good to see.
Yeah.
No, they're an interesting animal, Aaron. They're one that's, well, we're now, I think this would be our, with your, well, Androsarcus is obviously a little bit older and from a different part of the world, but we've got Calicotheres now, one of the ones that Drew did. So we're getting a bit of a picture of North America during the late Oligocene, haven't we?
Yeah.
We're getting a few more. I think what would be nice to see would be, we should start categorizing all of our species and put them on a big world map or something.
That would be cool. Yeah.
Mm. Right. Well, shall we charge headlong with jaws open wide into our emails for this week?
Yes. This creature feature is terminated.
Terminated.
Bing. You've got mail.
Ooh, it's an email.
Right, we're into this week's emails, and we'll kick things off with last week's question, which was, what is the oddest or rarest creature that has ever visited your garden? We've got some good responses here. Tom Gray has put, through sheer neglect, my parents' front garden reverted to a small but plucky little meadow a few years ago. The grasses grew to shin height and supported quite a few crickets, grasshoppers, and the noise we could hear from the living room was fantastic. The noise is long gone now, and they've slated over the entire thing. Oh, a lovely, lovely thought, but not as great an ending. But you'd be surprised how much just not mowing your grass makes a difference when it comes to the amount of insects you get out there. It's really impressive. Jen Babs has put, yesterday morning, as I looked out of the front window, there was a mandarin duck. And she's attached a photo. I think it's been adopted because there was a male and female mallard with it. They all took off together, cleaning up under the bird table. Picture isn't great, but it was through the window, and it's probably needs a clean as well. It's full of whippet nose art. So, yeah, she's included a photo of, yes, a mandarin duck hanging out with two mallards. So, yeah. Robin Clark has put, a bittern appeared and stayed for a day in our garden in North Devon. That's impressive. That's really impressive. Shelley Kendall has put, a stoat and a tree creeper. I know the stoat of which she talks. Not personally, obviously. Catherine Ames, not sure how rare, but the ruby-tailed wasp in my front garden last year was stunning. Recently, I saw a roe deer in our back garden, and that's pretty common in the UK, I know. And it's not unusual to see them around here, but it's still an awesome sight on a council estate. Here she is, and it's a pretty good picture of a roe deer in her back garden. To be honest, I'd be fascinated with the ruby-tailed wasps. I think they're gorgeous things. But yeah, getting a deer in your garden, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Matt Jack Dupe has put, common frog jumping out from under a plant pot. That's always nice. That's a nice surprise when you get frogs and toads under your plant pots. Philip Schofield has put, turtle dove. Always a nice one to hear. Kelsey Watts has put, we've got polecats who live under the hot tub at Mum's. I sent Aaron an audio video of them killing something, maybe a bunny, as Gareth calls them. Very good. The silence after death was truly harrowing. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I'll show you that. I'll send that clip to you. It's
that slightly harrowing clip, by the sounds of it, of just sounds in the night as something is being eaten. Although, imagine if you're in the hot tub and that happened. And Stephen Eddy has put, a nightjar. And of course he always gets things like that in his garden, the lucky bugger.
Yeah.
So that was last week's question.
So this week's question, in honor of the Deodon, is what is your favorite extinct mammal? And I would say that both you and I, Aaron, have got quite a few front runners for the spot there. But care to take a pick at your number one favorite extinct mammal?
Extinct mammal.
He's thinking.
I think I'm going to have to go with off the top of my head. It's got to be woolly mammoth.
Yeah, I had a feeling you'd probably go mammoth, and I would say that's probably going to be quite a common one as well. I mean, they are pretty big, pretty interesting animals.
They are the quintessential extinct prehistoric animal.
This is true. Mine goes mammal. I'm gonna go with the obvious. I think it's probably going to be the thylacine for me because they are just the one that I'd like to see. You know. And so recently disappeared. I would love to see them. Maybe to push Megaloceros. They fascinate me as well.
Yeah, they're cool. They're cool.
Right. Well, you can send us your favorite extinct mammal by doing that on our Facebook page, where that will be going up. You can join in that conversation as it goes up. We post new questions every week for you guys to ponder over and send us your answers. Also get in contact with us in various other ways other than our Facebook page. And we do have quite a few of you now interacting with us on our Facebook page, which is nice to see. You can also get in contact with us on our email. And that is, Aaron, who we got this week? I think we've got another email come through.
Yeah, we got another email from our new Patreon supporter, Nick Tenick. If you remember, guys, he joined Patreon at Animal Ambassador level. Last week, which Gareth, correct me if I'm wrong, that means he gets a shout out on the episode, he gets access to the newsletter, the monthly newsletter, and he gets to pick a creature for us to feature, which he's already done.
And that is true. Yeah, you get all of those things at that level. And that's, well, his ones will be coming up in our, I think it should be next month, they'll be coming out on that one. So yes, welcome along, Nick. What does he say?
It's a bit of a follow-up to last week's email, or rather a follow-up to our response to his email last week. He says, thank you for the kind words. I'm very proud and happy of what I have achieved so far, although I have a lot of work to do finishing this ecology degree. It may sound weird, but the death of my dog and best friend Bruce is what really pushed me to finally chase these dreams. So it was really touching having my email on the same episode as Charlie. My condolences for Gareth.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm also obsessed with the thylacine. There's no downside for fun little expeditions. The best outcome is finding one, of course, and then the worst case is spending quality time in the ancient Tasmanian wilderness. It really is a win-win. I'm so privileged to live here. Within a 5-minute radius of my house, there are platypus, echidna, bittong, bandicoot, eastern and spotted quolls, Tasmanian devils, yellow-tailed black cockatoos, and more. I could ramble all night to you guys.
Just going to get very jealous over here in the corner.
Yeah, we're not jealous at all.
No, not jealous at all. No.
Very, very, very cool, Nick. Very cool.
As a list of garden wildlife, or, you know, 5-minute away sort of wildlife, that's pretty damn good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of
that blows a lot of the answers out of the water for last week's question, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, just like one of those lists would be pretty good. But yeah, that list. Oh, that's good to see. Yeah, so thank you for sending that in. And if you want to send an email in like Nick, you can do so. Our email address is thenathistorycupboard@gmail.com, and you can send your messages in there. We will look at them and then, well, talk about it on the show. It's at this point as well we get to talk about our wonderful Patreons. Aaron, tell us all about our Patreons.
Yeah, we do. Nick isn't the only one. So we would like to thank Chelsea McKee, Connie P, Jen Greenhall, Vogtober, and Nick Tenick for being our loyal and absolutely amazing Patreon supporters. Yeah, so your continued support and help in that way is what helps us to get out and about and to do some things that hopefully are going to pay dividends and to you guys by giving you guys more content and improving the quality of the podcast overall. So
I still think we should put it all towards going out and finding thylacines in the wild.
Yeah.
I'll start putting it all aside for that trip.
Gareth's already planning the Patreon money. Category A is to get us to Tasmania to spot fighting. Category B is going to Professor Andrew Pask to help fund bringing Phylacines back from the dead.
Oh no, getting us a front row ticket for the day that he has one there in front of him, because I want to see that thing. So money isn't everything, obviously, and you can also help us out in many, many other ways. You can like, subscribe, and comment on whatever podcasting service you're listening to us on. Leave a rating or a review. That always helps immensely, pushes us up the charts. You can get in contact with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where we post daily about different things that are going on. We've got our fantastic T-Mill store as well, where all of the artwork that Drew has made goes and is turned into fantastic, well, T-shirts and hoodies and things. So that pretty much brings us to the point in the episode where I say a big thank you, Aaron, for coming along.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's all right. I think we're all looking good here. And a big thank you to you at home for listening. And we'll see you next time here in the Natural History Cupboard. Bye.
Bye.
One does not simply...
Get down!